Hey, welcome to the Happy Ramp Podcast. I am Ted Kluck, joined as always in studio by my good friends, my partners in radio, Barnabas Piper and Ronald J. Martin. Boys, it is a Monday morning recording sesh, something we don't often do. So it feels a little different to do radio in this context. But Piper, I'm going to let you do what you always do, which is pay some bills for us as a program and tell us about our sponsors.
Yeah, our sponsors this week are our longtime coffee mogul partnership with Redbud City Coffee Roasters. If you go to redbudcoffee.com, you can see their full list of roasts. It's a family-owned coffee roaster, and they actually also support every purchase supports an organization that fights sex trafficking as well. So by ordering coffee from Redbud, you're doing a little bit of additional good. And if there's anything that Christians like, it's consumeristic social justice. So we are strongly in favor of this. So if you go to redbudcoffee.com, you can see their full list of roasts. They rotate them through. They're all single origin from around the world. The Brazilian honey is my favorite. And then at checkout, be sure to use the code HAPPYRANT to get a 10% discount. They also sell in large bags, large bulk. So if you wanted to get it for a church or for an office or whatever, you could do that as well. Our second sponsor is Dwell Bible App. And you should be familiar with this by now, listeners. If you're a first-time listener, let me tell you a little bit about it. Dwell is an audio Bible app. It's available on all mobile devices. They have a whole selection of Bible versions and readers and background music and listening plans and features to help you memorize, to help you study, even to help you, you can listen to it while you go to sleep or put your kids to bed, and there's a sleep feature. So they just keep building this out. If you go to dwellapp.io/happyrant, that's dwellapp.io/happyrant, you can see what they're offering to our listeners, which is a 10% discount off of the annual subscription or a 33% discount off of the lifetime subscription. So that's under $100 lifetime access as they continue to build this out and add features and add plans and everything else. So again, check them out. Dwell Bible App. We love them. And one last thing, as it seems as the world is reopening a little bit with vaccinations going out there, COVID numbers reducing, all three of us are willing and able and eager speakers for whatever events you're starting to book for later in this year. So if you go to happyrantpodcast.com, there's a little place where you can book us or contact us each. So if you wanted to have all three of us out, or each one, you know, one of us individually, we won't be offended if one gets invited and the others don't. We would love to speak to, we've done student ministry stuff, men's conferences, preaching on Sunday mornings, camps, kind of the full gamut. So whatever it is that you would want to have us out for, we would be eager to do that. And I think all of us are kind of chomping at the bit after last year being stuck at home so much. So throwing that out to listeners as well.
Pipe, incredible work. And the boys getting back out on the road, Ronnie Tarmac, just this week. Where are you going, baby?
Yeah, doing a just getting back into a little Harbor Network work.
Harbor.
Getting back into a little trip to Louisville. Kentucky. And so nothing too far, nothing too exotic.
Not the full harbor like Naples, Florida treatment. You guys haven't like bought
not
your
yet.
Own island.
I mean, we got to work slowly into that, right? I mean, these are baby steps. These are getting us to that place.
You got to reach out to the Harbor Network oil baron who finances the whole thing. And
Right. He needs a little time and attention.
He's still a little nervous about COVID. He's a big COVID guy. So give it
a little bit nervous.
Yeah,
correct.
Give it some time. Boys, we've got a unique episode on tap, in that this is going to be one of those conceptual kind of one topic discussions, and I like this one. It's this: let's talk about something in our life we'd go back and change if we could, a decision, relationship, relocation, or opportunity missed, how God still used it for good, but you wonder what might have been. So something we would go back and change if we could, a decision, relationship, etc. I think this is really good. It's really interesting, really thoughtful. A couple of things immediately sprang to mind for me, but wondered what you guys thought about it. I'm not one of those bros who's like, bro, no regrets. You know, no regrets. One of those no regrets guys. I'm not one of those guys at all. I've got massive
Which
regrets.
Is always shocking, yeah. isn't it? Like when you hear, like I'm always surprised, and you mainly hear it from celebrities, you know, yeah. when they're doing these really deep
yeah.
interviews, you know, and, you know, they sort of had this past where, that they're emerging from.
Right.
And then the at one point, the interviewer always says, so, I mean, do you have regrets? And I feel like almost 10 for 10, these people always go, I don't.
Yeah.
I have zero regrets. I would do it all exactly the same way because it brought me to where I am and it made me the person that I am. And I'm yeah. sitting there going, dude, like, I've seen you on the cover of those magazines for some of those mistakes you made. Like, you'd go back to that?
Dude, right.
You'd do that again?
Like, you've been married yeah. 14 times. You almost died of right. a heroin overdose. Like, really? Huh?
You don't want to pare that down yeah. to married, like, I don't know, three times exactly. and no heroin overdose?
Exactly. You know? I don't know. Where are you guys at on this one? I've certainly got some dialed up, and I can talk about them. But
take it away.
Yeah. So
kick us off.
There's one that I'm kind of in the middle of right now, which is my movie. I wish I'd never collaborated with friends on it because it's killing me. And as you guys know, with creative stuff, just in a general sense, collaborations are the worst. But you know, like I'm kind of an idealist and I can't stay out of my own way in terms of involving my friends, and I involve them. And now, you know, invariably, because we're people and we all have different visions for the project, like they want to take it in some different directions. I don't know. I wish I just like sold it to a studio, been done with it, made a big pile of cash and moved on with my life. But, so yeah, that one, I feel like we're at this crossroads of, not only is the movie not going to be very good, it's also going to ruin our friendships. And I probably have a darker view of it than it is actually reality, but that's how it's feeling now. So I don't know. KK insists that it's a good thing that I did it the way I did it, but I have my doubts on that one.
I've never been in that position, but from the outside looking in on situations where people do either creative ventures or start a business or like plant a church with friends, I always think that doesn't seem worth it to me.
Yeah.
You know, keeping business and friendships separate, it seems wise to yeah. me. And I realize there's a touch of irony in the fact that the three of us are co-authoring a book right now. Hopefully we have enough of a basis to have made this work. But that seems so potentially risky yeah. to me. Because there's at least in my experience, to do anything well creatively or business wise, you have to be able to be very cut and dry and potentially hurt people's feelings, but it's not about them, it's about whatever problem you're trying yeah. to fix. But when you mix relationships in that, it really muddies the waters.
Yeah, it rarely seems to end well. I mean, because yeah. again, it's yeah, because especially for creative things, because everybody is – it's like creativity is something that is so connected to like the heart and the soul.
Yeah.
And so it becomes everybody's baby to the point to where if they have to relinquish any control over it, it just causes emotions then to just fly all over the room. And now you got all these emotions overlapping, just, you know, sort of like, you know, flying into each other. And then how do you resolve that, right? Because at some point – I mean, any creative endeavor, and you can talk about this, Big T, like mm-hmm. somebody has to compromise.
Oh, absolutely.
Like somebody's yeah. vision has, like everybody's vision has to be compromised
yeah.
to the point.
Yeah.
But like somebody's going to hold to something a little tighter than somebody else. And like who gets to relinquish? Like who gets to give away the largest percentage of what their ideal was
right.
for the endeavor, right? Somebody has to do it or it doesn't get finished.
Yeah. And it usually ends up being like the least a-hole guy in the room who you know, breaks down and relinquishes, which will end up being me at the end of the day. And it will, you know, it just will. And I'm going to reach a point where I'm like, you guys, forget it. Who cares? Put a robot fake dragon in the movie. I don't care. Just get it done. You know, get it out of my life. It's a millstone around my neck.
If you do that, is there like a tacit assumption that if you do that, you're also not allowed to be bitter about it? Or is it the understanding that since you did that, you forever get to be bitter about it and be like, well, if we had done it my way.
I mean, I think I'll get to be bitter about it. But the catch-22 with that one, Pipe, as you guys know, is that like for us as believers, it's not profitable or good or joyful or anything healthy for us to carry around bitterness. And the real kind of ironic rub with all this is that I've been collaborating in some form or fashion for 15 years and it's never gone well, but I've never learned, you know, I think that's the part of this that's so frustrating for me.
You know, it's funny because I think, you know, it's weird you say that, man, because I think a lot about, I've not done a lot of collaborative work. Mm-hmm. In fact, me and you, Big T, that's some of the most collaborative work I've ever done.
Well, that was actually the easiest one.
Well, and because I didn't, you know, it all depends. Like, there are certain things, depending on what it is in our personal lives. Like, I can go, like, okay, so let's just take it. I mean, Pipe just called it out, like the book that we're working on. Like, I don't think any of us are, like, have our hands around it so tightly to where it's becoming something, like, to where none of us can budge on any part of it. Right. You know, like, I feel like there's even the way we've approached it and the way we're writing it, the way we're in the middle of it, there's, like, a looseness to it that just allows it to be something where it's a true collaboration rather than one person's, you know, sort of art project that they pulled a couple other people into.
Right.
And so I think in that sense, it was like, hey, should we all do this? So it really from the get-go, it was like this collaborative thing. But I think other things, like if you're the one that like, if you're the one that was the brain behind it, or you're the one that initially made the step into dreaming it up, and then you bring other people into it, that makes it really hard. Because it means that, man, you are the one that cast the initial vision for it.
Yeah.
And how do you how do you compromise?
Right, right.
You know?
Well, and
it makes it so collaboration so hard.
It is so hard. And with a movie, like, it's intensely collaborative, and it has to be, because, you know, the guy who was really the impetus for making the movie was an actor who was a friend who was connected with people with money. And, you know, really his vision hasn't been the issue. He's been great. But you know, so then we brought these other friends in, and it's just gotten, you know, massively complicated. But anytime you're trying to do something that big, like, you can't do it on your own unless you're just a billionaire with unlimited resources. So, you know, it's one of those things, live and learn.
You need to have, like, a collaboration, you know, DTR talk beforehand, you know, in terms of, like, this is how this is going to work. I'm responsible for this. You're responsible for that. Don't step in my lane. I don't step in your lane, which is uncomfortable on the front end and probably makes some people go,
it's slightly idealistic too, but
it's uncomfortable, but it's also at the front end, that's when there's the most enthusiasm, because everybody's like stoked that it's happening and full speed ahead, and everybody's just doing their stuff. So you think, oh, this feels good. This feels healthy. We don't need to DTR this thing. But actually, you're right, Pipe. That's the thing that most needs to happen at the beginning of those deals. But yeah, I've gone on one, man. I've got a whole like truckload of regrets yet to go. But where are you guys at, baby? This is your topic. Do you have one?
Yeah. I don't know why I was thinking about this morning, because me and Big M were having a convo kind of related to some of these things. But I remember this was way back in the day, and it was right as I was getting into a bunch of music stuff. And I had somebody from a Bible college approach me, because I had done some sort of leadership-y things, like kind of in our youth ministry, which was kind of one of those larger kind of big church youth ministries. So it kind of got some attention, you know, kind of a thing. And I remember somebody approached me and offered me sort of the opportunity to, you know, at like, I don't know, 19 or 20 years old, or one of the, you know, something like that, some age like that. And to, you know, kind of roll out this opportunity. Hey, you should think about ministry. I see some things in there that I think could, you know, kind of lead down this path. And I really thought about it, but I've been working so hard on all this music stuff. And I went to my brother and I said, man, I'm thinking about this. I'll have to kind of move away. And he just was like, you cannot do this. We're just like, all this stuff starting to happen. We've put all this work, you know, all this stuff that you've been dreaming about, blah, blah, blah. You can't do it. You can't do it. And so I let it go. I pursued the music stuff, which, you know, took me through the next 20 years or whatever. And God used all the music stuff for better, for worse. But I always wonder, because I got kind of a late start into vocational ministry, and I always wonder what it may have been like had I just taken that step, where I would be. Of course, I'd be in a different place today, like you always would when you make a different decision.
Yeah.
But I always wonder, like, man, was that like God was doing something through that person in that moment, and I pushed back on it, and here I am today. You know, eventually the Lord brought me into whatever he wanted to bring me into. But you just, like, you have to wonder, like, how much more developed and how much more progress I would be experiencing in some particular areas that, you know, I didn't experience until later on. And I think, you know, obviously we can always wonder that and say that I made a step to the right instead of the left. And so it caused certain growth and, you know, certain situations to be suspended or to never happen at all. But there's that one moment I always look back on. I go, oh man, I wonder what would have happened if I would have said yes.
Yeah.
Of course I wouldn't have done all the music stuff that I did, and you know, all of that shaped so much and led me to where I'm at today. So God used it, but you got to wonder.
Yeah.
I have a sneaking suspicion that if you had gone into ministry at 19, you would have been out of ministry by like 28.
Yeah, that's probably true. Well, you'd be doing the music stuff now.
You know, you talked about how much more developed, and yeah, well, you'd be doing like the Gungor kind of thing now or something, you know, just in terms of, and that's not a shot at you, but just the arc of people who kind of, they get into this really difficult, complex space of vocational ministry too young and underdeveloped to know how to handle it. And so my sense is that you're probably way better at it having gotten into it as an adult than as a, you know, a post-pubescent teen kind of thing. I feel the same thing in my life, you know, so I didn't get into vocational ministry until I was 36, something like that, 35. And that feels really late to the game in some ways, but also a lot of the things that eat up young ministers, I look at and I'm like, that doesn't seem like a big deal to me. You know, in terms of the finding out how to balance work and home life and the some of the challenges of life. Like, there's just a fair amount of life that pours into ministry to be like, yeah, I think I just have a more level head than I would have at 24, plus character development, plus whatever else. So, yeah, as much as that's I think it's a valid question, like the what ifs, but also I bet you're a better pastor now because you didn't get into it at 20.
Yeah, and I agree. And I think, yeah, some of the things, and that constantly comes back to me because I work with younger pastors who are in their 20s. And, you know, you just kind of look at some of the things that they don't know because they can't know because they haven't experienced it. And you just kind of go, well, Lord, it's an unusual path that you brought me on, but I'm thankful for some of that because I learned some of the things that they're learning in ministry out of ministry so that by the time I got into ministry, the ministry isn't in some way suffering some of those things that I'm going through. And of course, that's not a hit at them. That's just where God has them. But you got to wonder. You know what I mean? You just wonder for sure. Yeah.
Yeah, I think too, if people are
– Oh,
go ahead, Pipe. I'm sorry.
Not – you. Go,
yeah, I think if you're getting pulled into ministry at age 19, you're almost certainly getting pulled in for the wrong reasons. You know, it's because you're good looking or charismatic or good in front of people or whatever and not because you have anything like – you know, really reasoned or nuanced or profound to say.
Well, there's been no opportunity for, there's really not been an opportunity for there to be a lot of fruit.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Somebody sees attributes in you, but yeah, you're right. Like the fruit, the kind of learning that you would want to have taken place, you know, can't have taken place by then in most cases.
It's fascinating.
I was going to say as well that one of the advantages to come into ministry later is, you know, for guys who get into it early, there's sort of a sense of like ministry is this unique, you know, it's such a unique role. Nobody else can totally understand it. And having come in, you from the music industry, me from publishing and other things, you come in and you go, yeah, there are definitely aspects of ministry that are very different than every other calling, job, occupation, whatever. But it's not nearly as unique as some people want to make it. So like the bubble that we keep ourselves in is probably way more transparent and way more accessible because so much is transferable between what it looks like to be a faithful Christian musician or a faithful Christian marketer or a faithful Christian editor and being a faithful Christian pastor. And then there's the unique aspect of it that it's just a way smaller core of what that is. And so you just kind of feel less special in your role. You're like, yeah, this is the thing that God has for me to do. But also, like, I'm not like some you know, uniquely called special prophetic anything. I'm God just put me here to do this thing.
Yeah,
it's a more humbling. It's a more – you come into it a little more – you don't always, but you have the opportunity to come into it later a little more humble than you would have at 20 years old, thinking that you know everything that a 20-year-old thinks they know. You know, I mean,
dude, hopefully, but then you meet some like 50-year-old guys who aren't even remotely humble, and you wonder how.
Well,
that
I mean, for sure, yeah, 100, yeah,
yeah. I wish I knew everything now that I thought I knew at 20.
Yeah, I know. Wouldn't that be great?
Truly.
How far would you boys be if you were smart as you were at 20 years old?
No question.
No offense to all of our 20-year-old listeners, obviously.
That's true. We love our 20-year-old listeners.
I don't mind offending them a little bit. It's okay. they could probably
no one else is offending
use a little
them.
Offense.
Speaking as someone in the college business.
That's right.
Boys, do you have one more, maybe? One more thing?
I was thinking about it, and it was a challenging question for me because I'm not a no regrets person. There are definitely things in my life that I regret, particularly because of the pain that they caused others. You know, decisions that I've made that have been detrimental to others, whether it was just foolishness or sin or some combination of the both. So those are the ones that I would like to go back and undo. Mm-hmm. However, almost every one of my worst decisions has been pivotal in God growing me as a Christian and teaching me. I'm just a really stubborn, dumb person when it comes. I only learn by mistakes, apparently, not by listening. And so I had to get to the point of, oh, those are the severe consequences for this idiocy before learning what faithfulness looks like, or, you know, consistency or maturity or any of those things. The one thing that stands out in my mind that I look back on and go, I don't know the benefit of that dumb decision, and I really wish I could do it differently, was I think I completely wasted my education.
Oh, yeah.
I was the laziest, most self-centered student Wheaton College has ever seen. I was there to do whatever I wanted to do and just didn't have a sense of the opportunity that I was squandering at the time. In terms of the amazing professors, the environment on campus, even the friendships I had there, you know, all my friends were pretty diligent students, and I just didn't follow their lead at all. And I was there for intramural sports and to hang out with friends and to participate in the classes that I thought were worth my time, as if at 19, I had any idea what was worth my time.
Yep.
And I just wonder what direction my life would have taken had I learned a work ethic and a level of humility to sit down and go, maybe I'm not smarter than my professors. Maybe it's worth it to like put off ultimate frisbee for the sake of, you know, actually studying for this exam. And I just didn't ever. Maybe by my junior and senior year, I developed a little bit of that. But I think that was mostly the fact that by that time, I was only taking my major classes, and I liked most of those. Yeah. So I don't think it was work ethic as much as convenience.
Yep.
So grad school has kind of been off the table for me because I really don't enjoy school. But also in the back of my mind, I'm like, yeah, I was a trash student. And so in my mind, I'm still a trash student. Even though it's been 20 years since I was in college.
Dude, let me make a little bit of an argument for you on the grad school thing. I was a trash student as well. Every single thing that you said a minute ago about your undergrad experience applied to me, including thinking that you hated school because of it. But then I went to grad school about a decade ago, I guess, as an adult, and absolutely loved it. It was a blast. The work was fun. The classes were fun. It was like everything that undergrad wasn't in a lot of ways. And I don't know. I think as a mature adult now, especially as one with like a sense of your own fallibility, I don't know. I think you would really dig it. But, it's not for everybody. And the timing of life isn't for everybody. And I know there's factors. Going back and doing that as an adult was great for me.
And that's the crazy thing, because and I would be interested to hear what Ronnie has to say about this, because obviously he's done seminary and now is in doctoral work as an adult, not as, you know, straight out of college kind of thing. But I've done so many things that are the equivalent to all the stuff I hated in college, and I enjoy it. You know, every time if I prepare to teach or preach, like there's studying, there's taking notes, it's essentially a big old pile of homework.
Right.
You know, I've written four books. Well, that's a lot of papers,
right.
And just so on and so forth, all of those things. And so And all of which has been well worth it and generally enjoyable. You know, I don't enjoy every minute of it, but that's work. And yet in my mind, the idea of school is an utter drag. It's just soul-sucking to me, even though it's probably almost a one-to-one correlation between what school would be like now and what writing a book is like now or preparing to teach or whatever those things right. are.
Absolutely.
Interesting.
Ronnie, how has your school experience been coming to it? You know, you came to ministry later and yeah. then also going back for grad school.
Yeah, I mean, it's been – so here's the thing. Like you guys had that 4-year experience that I missed out. You know, I was in the School of Rock and Roll during those mm-hmm. years that I should have been just doing a 4-year undergrad program. So I missed out on all that. And so ministry, you know, kind of coming into ministry in the way that I did kind of served as sort of my undergrad in some ways. And so all this post-grad work I've done has really been kind of my introduction into, you know, seminary life, college life, university life, however you want to phrase it. So it's been really interesting. It's, you know, man, it's such, I mean, Piper, you know this, it's, and maybe we all feel this way, but it really is, it's a different experience for different personalities. I'm just not an academic. So, I really slog through things. Like I don't learn well from these really crazy, like heavy, highly academic, like books that they make you read that are never under 726 pages. And, you know, writing papers, although I write quickly, I write efficiently, I tend to get okay grades. Like none of it is anything that I feel like produces a lot of life and enjoyment inside of me. So I learn a lot from it. I really do. But I would prefer to be learning. I've learned more on the job and I prefer that style of learning, over, you know, kind of hitting the books and being in that environment. That's just a stifling environment for me. And that's just me. That's just my personality. And again, you know, kind of going back to what you said a minute ago, I think not having spent that time like you guys did, it had remained like an undisciplined kind of feature in my life for so many years that getting back into it and having to sit in front of a laptop for hours on end, like typing out papers, it's just not awesome. It's just not awesome for me, even though I'm benefiting from it. I'm learning from it. I'm glad I'm doing it. But in terms of the enjoyability factor, it's for sure a slog.
Well, it's a certain kind of writing that isn't creative and it isn't meant to put on for an audience. You know what I mean? Which is why I hated writing papers in college, versus writing professionally. Writing professionally is fun because you're always putting on for an audience or trying something new or whatever. But, yeah.
And you're doing it your way. There's not a form that you're expected to. I read the occasional academic book now and I hate them so much.
Yeah, they're brutal. They're kind of brutal.
They're bad. Like, academic writing is bad writing.
Yeah.
It just by any measure except their own, like they have decided this is how it should be done. Except it's terrible communication. Mm-hmm. It doesn't make things any clearer. In fact, it usually makes things more opaque.
Yeah.
And it rarely helps me to the point of going, oh, that's what they're trying to get at.
Yeah. Dude, did you guys?
It's just like layer upon layer of I read this and I studied this and this guy says this and I'm like, I don't care. Just get to the
right,
point.
Right.
What is your point?
What are you trying to say? You know, and you could probably say it in a page and a half. Did you guys read Carl Truman's deal? The thing with the guy and the iPad on the front, the one that just came out like a year ago.
Oh, the one that's getting all the hype.
Evangelical Book of 2020 that we've already forgotten about.
Yeah. I'm reading it now.
Did you read it?
Yeah, I'm in it now, and I'm kind of having that experience with it because it's sort of like half college paper and half like popular thing that people are supposed to enjoy, and it's sort of mixed in that way. I love it. I love Carl. I think he's the best kind of like cranky guy that we need right now. But yeah,
I think he's a good writer, yeah. but he's a prof. So he kind of like all those dudes, they intermingle a lot of like, you know, a lot of the academy in their writing.
Yeah. It's got like Mark Knoll energy, you know, like this is really just a gigantic white paper that I threw a decent looking cover on. But
he is a good writer, though.
He is.
Make it compelling.
Yeah, he is. Sure. And I'm enjoying it. And I love what he has to say. Like 100%. I'm in on it. But it's not like something that we would write, you know.
It seems to me I think the reason I dislike academic writing so much, and I haven't read Truman's book, so I don't know if this is true of that, is it's the opposite of what makes good preaching.
Mm.
Like a good academic paper is the exact opposite of good preaching, in that good preaching is you do a ton of work and you boil it down to the most kind of condensed and maximum point. Mm-hmm. So your job is to, you know, you know all the background, but you're not communicating all the background. You're communicating the point. Academic writing is the exact opposite. It's like, what is a point? We're going to show off all of our research. This whole thing is an exercise in all of the work that we did. And so there's merit in it from a, if you're looking to study a topic, but it's just, it is just a dog of a
it's a slog.
A reading experience.
It's such a slog.
And it's so bad.
And to be clear, listeners, our book is the furthest thing from that. If there ever was a book, that's far from that kind of writing.
Oh, absolutely.
I would like to know how many minutes either of you have spent researching, and I said minutes because I know it's not more than that, any of the portions of this book.
Approximately 0 minutes for me at this point.
Yeah.
Unless we count recording episodes as research, in which case it's about 25 to 55 minutes per week.
That's right. Yeah. Let's stick with that. So it's
some guys, though, are just gaga over research, you know?
So yeah.
I think so. You know, I mean, I know we're kind of rabbiting here, but I think that's what's fascinating, too, though, to your point, Pipe, is that there are, believe it or not, and you know this is rhetorical, but like there are dudes out there, there are women out there that read those academic books and they just lap them up like they love them. Like they're just fascinated by all the intricacies and all the research. And it's baffling to me.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Those people should be on a watch list somewhere. That's terrifying.
It is to me too, but it's a little bit of a flexing opportunity for those people too, though. You know, you can read it and then you can flex about it and how much you enjoyed it. And, you know,
it's the culture that
makes everybody else feel
stupid.
The
culture they want to be in.
Yeah. Yeah. Totally. Totally.
Crazy.
Yeah. It is crazy. Boys, any more regrets? Any big life-changing moments you would do differently?
I'm trying to figure out. Maybe you guys can help me because you're both slightly further along in parenting than I am. Mm. I'm trying to figure out where my parenting regrets should lie.
Oh, interesting. Mm.
You know, there's a sense in which I'm very open-handed and I'm like, my children are, they're my responsibility in a sense, but it's not like they're the clay and I'm the potter. But also, I have a growing sense that maybe I have screwed them up, you know, just, and maybe that's just the nature of them growing into adolescence and there's different challenges, but I'm just like, oh boy,
Pipe, let me posit something.
There are some real challenging days here. The days are better on the one hand, but some days are just bad.
Let me posit something by way of encouragement and by way of like, I don't know, without saying too much, we've just come out of a, I don't know, as a church or a small group or whatever, kind of a brutal thing with somebody. But I'll say it this way. I think the fact that you have those concerns is proof that you're probably doing a good job. And because the guy that I'm most scared of is the guy who thinks that he's an amazing parent and that he's never made a mistake and that his teenage kids are, you know, incredible missionaries already. And
yeah, they're just crushing
they're
it.
They're just crushing it left and right all over the place. Like that's the guy that I'm most scared of in any kind of a church setting.
Well, I'm the exact opposite. I mostly go through life wondering if I ever made any, like every decision I make parenting, I'm like, I don't know if I did that.
Well, dude, and you probably have made some mistakes. I know we have, but like, I think the ability to have your eyes open about that and be humble about it and take input from your church and other people and glean wisdom and ask questions, like that's probably the best thing you have going for you as a parent, to be honest. And, you know, I think the other stuff will fall into place, but maybe I'm oversimplifying. Baby, man of the cloth, speaking to Piper's question.
Yeah, you know, gosh, it's so complex because, I mean, God uses us to shape our kids, and yet he's the one that shapes our kids. And so, man, I for sure have regrets, and they really lie in the realm of, I wish that I would have put more emphasis on my own spiritual development with my child, my daughter, rather than sort of pitching her to, you know, the youth groups that she grew up in, the churches that we are part of. And so I would have said in the moment, of course I'm not doing that. But knowing the environment she was in, I backed away from some of those more intentional sort of patterns that I wish we would have established in our lives together, because it was like, well, I mean, she's going to be there on Sunday nights, Wednesdays, Saturday morning, you know, whatever the whole pattern was with that. And so I look back at that and I went, oh, you kind of handed that off a little bit, which is the cliche.
Mm-hmm.
And I wish that it would have been a little more hands-on and intentional from my side of things. Now, I mean, you say that and it's like, you know, God's still going to work the way he's going to work. I mean, you look at these dudes that are serving, or these women that are serving Jesus right now, that had the most horrendous like upbringings in the world. And then you look at these people that, you know, had the most faithful, godly upbringings in the world, and they couldn't be further away from Christ. And you just go, man, God's just working through all of our screw ups constantly.
Yeah.
You know, it's just, you have to have some hope and confidence and faith that, man, he's using us. But he ultimately is just going to do what he wants to do. I mean, that's where our sovereignty, that's where our high God, you know, sovereignty of God theology really, I think it helps us quite a bit. It has to, or we're just not going to be sleeping much. And I need to sleep.
Well, and even in that though, there's a certain amount of humility baked into that, that I think is good for us. You know, if we are going to sleep, if we are going to celebrate sovereignty, then it comes from a place of some humility.
I think the risk that I feel drawn to this sometimes, or I kind of wonder where the line is the difference between kind of what Ronnie just said, which is, you know, we have responsibility to our kids, but God is going to do what God does. And then sort of the fatalistic, hyper Calvinist, like, whatever, God's going to do things. And, and so kind of it's essentially we get to punch out on this one. And I have 100% used that mindset as an excuse to not be as devoted and attentive as I should to especially spiritual things in the past years. Just like, well, this is in God's hands. Mm-hmm. Not realizing fully that, yes, but God also put the kids in my hands. And so there's a both and there.
Yeah.
So it's
sure.
that fatalistic aspect of things can be a temptation for
but
sure.
But I think for you, Pipe, Big T just said, I mean, the fact that you even asked the question, you know, it's like our lives are, in a good way, I think our lives are so wrapped up into our kids. They're our flesh and blood. And so, I mean, there is a part, I mean, if you were that fatalistic, that would just be more of you being a bad parent that didn't care very much or love your kids very much. So, I mean, the fact that I love my daughter to the degree that I do, it means that, man, that responsibility that God had given me, I wish I would have done a better job in that responsibility. But I know that all these years later, now that she's an adult and she's on her own, I mean, the Lord has to do what he wants to do, because I, you know, none of that is under my control anymore anyway. And by the way, it never really was.
Yeah.
And so that's not fatalism. That's just going, Lord, I'm seeing more of how the control that you have over the situation is what ultimately leads me back to grace and then rest and all of that.
I think a lot of it too is like allowing our kids to see the affections of our hearts. And if they see us loving the church and going with a joyful spirit and, you know, loving the word and being in the word, and, you know, yeah, we're going to screw up at times in terms of how we convey that to them. But if they see a joyful, teachable, humble, like, love of Christ in our hearts, then I think that will be compelling to them more than any, like, I don't know, programmatic, mechanical, you know, okay, we're going to read the Bible for 20 minutes and we're going to grind through this kind of thing that you would do with them or not do with them. So, I hope, you know, and I hope in our house that creates a, just kind of an environment of openness where they can talk and ask questions and doubt. And some of the stuff that Piper wrote about, I want this to be the kind of place where that can take place. And, but who knows, man, at the end of the day, who knows if we're doing it right? I guess we'll know when they're old, but there's definitely worries for sure. Boys, here's the deal. We can wrap it. We can keep going. We've put in a tidy 38 minutes. I feel like this has been a good run for a Monday morning, a good amount of work.
I feel good. Let's wrap it.
Yeah. I think we're in a good spot. I feel that was therapeutic good. In the best sense.
Whatever we can do for you, Pipe, you know, you can get up off the chaise lounge and swipe your insurance card on the way out, and, you know, we'll be good. But boy,
Yeah, I recently started watching The Sopranos, and I'm just like two or three episodes in.
Yeah.
And I feel very much like, this feels like one of those therapy scenes. Like, I feel like I'm good to go. I'm back.
Dude, that first ep with like the duck on the pool, on the pool in his backyard. Yes. Crazy, man. What a show. Boys, we've done what we always do on this show. Also, what a show about our show. We've done what we always do, and that we've wandered to and fro throughout, in this case, one topic. And until next time.
The Happy Rant is brought to you by Resonate Recordings. If you go to resonaterecordings.com, you can see the full range of services they offer. So if you're considering starting a podcast, they are the ones we recommend going with. Again, go to resonaterecordings.com to see their prices, to connect with them and ask any questions, and to see what they can do to help you launch, edit, master, and improve your podcast. Again, go to resonaterecordings.com to see what they can do to help you launch and improve your podcast.
Our world can feel chaotic and uncertain, but we don't have to live enslaved to fear. Christ has promised me and you his peace, and throughout Scripture has provided powerful tools and practical steps to help us experience greater freedom. I'm Jennifer Slattery, lead host of the Faith Over Fear podcast, inviting you to join me and my team as together we learn how to starve our fears and feed our faith. Subscribe at lifeaudio.com or wherever you access podcast content.